It's my pleasure to talk a little bit today about how brain measures can help to understand collective group decisions. This is part of a broader effort Wolfgang Geismeier and Susanne Goldlücke and our team. We are striving to explore this using brain measures. And in doing so, I would walk you through a little bit what we think we can do in the near future. And before we turn to the brain, we need to talk a little bit about the group and the individual, because it ever since the beginning of social sciences, it was a big issue in social science, and vastly opposite views have been proposed. One is that because there are only individual brains, so this is what counts. So you investigate the individual brain. If you've done this thoroughly, you've explained everything, nothing left. There is the other point of view, of course, which starts by society. And it says, look, go from country to country. There are such huge differences between countries in terms of marriage, political systems, financial system, economics, everything. And the basic psychology, the biology is always the same. So you have to have a different view, and you can say the individual brain is the product of society. Now from this, you can take two turns. One is to give the group a superpower, something extra added. And that was taken, that view, by some sociologists, Durkheim for instance, who said you have other laws to explain everything of interest from a societal perspective. And part of it was how psychology dealt with the individual at that time. There was behaviorism. Elementary stimulus-response relationships were studied, and the social was added. It was just the same thing added to the explanation. So at the end, human activities are all explained as consummation of either primary needs or secondary rewards learned. And that actually was not a really good explanation and accepted by everyone. Psychoanalysis made a similar, very easy account. There were instincts, they wanted to be acted out, and they were clashing with society. There was a veto. And that actually was why we developed reasoning, to somehow deal with these balances. But at the end, whether you become a professor, whether you become an artist, whether you become a politician, it was all explained as a transformation of sexual energies. Now, that's a kind of explanation, but not really a satisfactory explanation for any kind of social processes. Because whatever you say, you know the answer beforehand. And that's not really a good help. So there were these polar thinking. Here is the individual. The group is as the unit of the group, which we need to investigate. And here is the societal level. And how can we bring them together? And Solomon Asch was the first who actually brought them together. And he said that there is something distinct about humans and the way we are built that led us to develop specific social and cognitive abilities, and that we have this kind of unique mental structure. So studying the rat will not necessarily lead you to a good understanding of human social behavior. And what his thinking was, that we have a mental representation of others. We have shared representation, shared social field. And that is in a Gestalt-like view, is a very kind of an interesting figure-ground part-whole relationship, because the whole is represented in the part, which is unique. And he derived the foundation of social psychology out of this notion of shared mental representations leading to cooperation, leading to joint attention, to joint intentionality, which was, at the time he wrote it, very well elaborated. And if we zoom forward, we see, for instance, Michael Tomasello, former MPI director at Leipzig, that he thinks of shared attention, shared intentionality, as unique for humans. leading to a kind of unique abilities and competencies. And what is interesting is that this starts right after birth. We are social people, we are social in a way of emotional sharing. At 9 months, there is joint attention, and then there is all the way to joint goals, all the way to a fully developed humans. So we are always social, a social animal with kind of a unique mental and cognitive abilities, because we can share our perspectives. And this is the background from which now we can turn towards the how we study social processes using brain measures, because when we bring people to the lab, they are already equipped with this kind of functioning, so we can study them focusing on the individual brain, if we like. Focusing on the individual brain, I was struck how rapidly we can extract emotional meaning. This is going by the fly. I did the research, later I found out that these hypotheses were not new. They were formulated without knowing by me 15 years earlier. They were noted by another eminent social psychologist in What Directs Our Attention. They were formulated by Ash, that he said that our hopes and desires spring directly from the event. They were formulated already by Helmholtz, when he said there is unconscious inference, and explicitly gave the example of an actor acting out and producing emotions in the public. But with brain measures, we can now look at this. How do we extract meaning, and how good are we in extracting meaning? Now, how do we study this? I would like to show you a little video. If you don't like to see pictures of erotica, pictures of violation and mutilation, just direct your eyes and your attention away from the screen for a moment. This was a stream. It was not playing properly. You could tell that the processor had come some kind of slowing. That was presumably a rate of three pictures per second. Fairly fast, but you could recognize all the pictures. Of course, we can speed it up. We can go all the way to 16 pictures a second. And then we can see how is the brain dealing with this kind of information. And what we do to examine the speed of processing and how the brain responds to significant stimuli, we measure EEG. Here you see Martin, who you will later hear about his research in more detail, having an EEG cap on it with 257 sensors. And what we do is we collect synaptic talking. It's postsynaptic potentials, which are summed up if they form a dipole and are measurable from the scalp. To give you a more intuitive feeling what we do when we measure event-related potentials, this is a stadium filled with individual spectators, meaning neurons. And with the EEG, we are in a helicopter, far above the stadium, because what we pick up is a very tiny minute signal. And when something happens in the world, only a fraction of neuron actually is responding to these kind of stimuli. So what we need to do to extract the brain signal is we need to repeat events, and that's why it's called event-related potentials. And what we then do, sitting in our helicopter, we try to see if there is a reproducible activity at certain spots in the stadium that certain spectators act because an event happened. So if there is a goal, we see that there is activity, and a group of spectators show synchronized behavior resulting in a dipole, we can pick it up, we can make it visible. And to go ahead a little bit, the second method I want to talk about today is functional magnetic resonance imaging that has a clear link to what I just told you. It's a measure related to blood flow. So if our spectators didn't act because there is a goal in a meaningful way, that is the neural activity. If our spectators, a few seconds later, they drink a sip of beer, that's the blood flow rushing in this region. So the EEG measures neural activity. The fMRI measures blood flow, lawfully related to neural activity. And the difference is that here we have high temporal resolution. With the fMRI, our helicopter goes down. We have a much better resolution of where the activity is happening, and we can also go deep in the brain, which the EEG has severe limitations. Otherwise, they are complementary methods. So now you've seen the video, and now I can show you the brain signature of emotional significance. And it is a difference between emotional intensity. So pleasant and unpleasant are emotionally strong stimuli, and at that level of processing, the brain signal we generate responds primarily to the intensity. So this is strong minus weak, neutral, mundane stimuli. If you focus on the movie I will show you in a second, you will first see blue, and then it will be replaced by a shift towards red, and that is the signature. If it works. These were 400 milliseconds what your brain is doing when confronted with emotionally significant stimuli. It takes about 120 milliseconds before a notable difference starts. And then there is this blue potential, the first one, and then there is this red emerging. They are, with this movie different, difficult to separate, but we have good reasons that these are two different components which have a meaning by their own. But this is the brain signature to emotional stimulus significance. Now we can now take this and get more social. And how to get more social is to bring two people in the lab. And we adopted here empathy designed by Tanya Singer to the EEG environment. So we invited couples, and under the assumption that they care for each other, they are placed on a chair and they lay their hand on the table. We attach an electrode, and I'm not saying it's an electric shock they receive, but it is a mildly aversive electrotactile stimulation. And then they see errors on the screen. These errors are cues. And the direction tells you who will be the target of the next, in the next trial. And the color tells you whether you get a no pain electrotactile stimulation or whether you get a pain stimulation. And the interesting thing is, this is a completely arbitrary error. Without any verbal explanation, you would not do a whole lot of things with this error. Now, if it points to you, it's self-relevant. And of course, you care whether you get a pain or not a pain. And this is the template we can then use and see, what are you doing when your partner is the target? Is it the same brain signature UVZ, or is it a different one? Now you see the difference again between a pain cue and a control cue. For the self, you are the target. You know that soon you will get the shock, or your partner. But it's to the cue, it's not to the stimulation, it's just to the error. I'd show you again, because this goes by rapidly. This is 500 milliseconds. And what you see is blue followed by red. Before, you saw it to emotional stimulus material, but showing emotional scenes. Now you see to errors, and it's poorly driven by, you know, what's happening. And you see, this is a paradigm where you can see that if I know that something happens to my partner, it has the same brain signature. My attention is directed in the same similar way as when I am the target. So we can examine these processes exploring the individual brain. And but this is still, if we talk about group processes, a little bit far away. This is a way lots of research is done, and people here in the audience could give also a full-length talk about these issues. But if we want to talk about group processes and these phenomena, we want to go a little bit beyond. And if our idea is that at some point we want to capture collective engagement, mutual alignment, and these mutual coordination processes, we need to have different paradigms. With the standard method, these are discrete stimuli, and it's a ritual. The stimuli are repeated. There are tiny measurements, and by repetition, we can make them visible. But if we want to be more, to our studies to be more naturalistic, we need different ways to capture the brain in action. And one way to capture naturalistic stimulus processing was in a landmark study described by Uri Hazon. And his idea was, what makes a Hollywood blockbuster successful? Well, they drive all the viewers in a similar way. And so they direct their attention in very definite ways that they are being very successful. So what he thought is that if a good movie engages the brains of participants in a highly synchronized way, we can use this to measure neural activity across participants, not across stimuli. And that way, we can examine highly, fully naturalistic stimuli. Now, how this works is, there is a movie shown, and this is one participant, this is one voxel of brain activity, approximately 700,000-800,000 neurons contribute their activity to this voxel. And when the movie unfolds, there is a sequence measured by functional magnetic resonance imaging. The blood flow is made visible in this voxel. And if this is a good movie, then the other brain acts in a similar way. Thereby, their responses are highly synchronized, they show a high correlation, and this approach is called the inter-subject correlation approach. And it can study naturalistic stimuli without relying on stimulus repetition. You can repeat this voxel by voxel, and then you get brain maps. And what Uri Hazon early on already described is that you get synchronized processing not only in acoustic and visual sensory perceptual regions, but also in higher order regions implicated in emotion processing, which are highly interesting. Now, when we heard, learned about this method, we thought this is cool. Ralf Schmelzle, our former postdoc, went to Uri Hazon's lab and learned that method because we were interested in health psychology and mass media campaigns. This is the backbone of public health campaigns. And you can study them in a way with discrete stimuli. We have to study them as they are used. These are naturalistic stimuli. So in our first study, we focused on the swine flu pandemic. At that time, the swine flu pandemic was new in Germany. It was a new threat, and there were TV documentaries aired to the public to inform them. Now, this particular one we selected was a 30-minute documentary, and it had elements of a Hollywood blockbuster. There were elements of suspense, empty soccer stadiums, empty airports, empty train stations because of the flu pandemic. There was threat. There was a switch to the Spanish flu back. There were expert interviews, all highlighting that there was a catastrophe coming. Now, in addition, whether this can entrain the brain in synchronized ways, we were interested in what effect has the state of the individual looking at the video. So we screened participants, and some of them said they are very worried about the swine flu, and others were cool. They were not concerned at all. So now we had not only the movie, we also had different groups of people, worried versus not worried, which we could compare. So we can ask two questions. What are the regions which are entrained by all groups? And what is specific to those people which are worried, which have a high risk perception? Now we calculated the inter-subject correlation. And what you here see is the low-risk group and the high-risk group. And you see in the back of the brain, in posterior regions, devoted to visual and acoustic processing, devoted to attention regulation processes, they are all engaged. And they are all engaged to a similar extent in low and high-risk groups. So this documentary entrained the brain of the viewers in a very synchronized way. And it's about 30-33% of the voxels, at least, which gets entrained, which is a rather large number. Here you get a glimpse that in anterior brain regions, there is some extra going on in the high-risk group. And if we test this formally with appropriate ways, the reviewer made us do everything under the sun to make sure this effect is real, we find activity in the anterior cingulate cortex. And this is a higher order brain region, and this is a brain region very often investigated in animal research, in human research. In human research, we know that from a lot of reviews that instructed fear, negative affect, fear appraisal, those are all the keywords connected to the activation within this structure. So, and that is a differential activation. They all see the same information. In perceptual regions, in attention regulation regions, this is the same activity we see. Higher order regions devoted to emotion processing respond differentially, so we are one step closer. We can possibly measure naturalistic stimulus processing conditions. Now, there is not that often a new fear pandemic, and we hope we don't want to wait for it, and we don't hope for it. So we turn to another risk in our next study, which is alcohol. Alcohol is insofar interesting because it's a risk which our group, young students, understand. And they show the risk behavior because quite a portion at the University of Konstanz would be classified as at-risk drinkers. So this is something we can study. And before we varied the person characteristics, now we wanted to vary the stimulus characteristics. What we did, very simple. We collected, or Martin, simple sounds, but it was a lot of work, collected all anti-alcohol campaigns aired in Western speaking media, TV, etc., and screened them, and using measures from communication science for their effectiveness. And some of them are really effective, others are not. They are all, of course, designed to be effective, but they are not all equally effective. So we ended up having 10 effective anti-alcohol campaigns according to communication science measures, and 10 ineffective ones. And to give you an impression, I show you one movie. You can then guess whether it's an effective or ineffective one. And the bold activation, this is half of our sample, and this is the other half. When there is a red, bold activation, blood flow increases. If there is a blue, there is a decrease in bold. And this is time locked now to this one commercial to give you an impression. And the ISC would compare the similarities between these two brains. This is how synchronized the responses are. So this was an impression. Now we did, of course, this formally for each of our 20 stimuli, and we compared the intersubject correlation driven by low versus highly effective anti-alcohol campaigns. And what you see, if you look first in the posterior brain regions here, you see that the effective and the less effective ones were driving sensory perceptual processing regions quite a bit. So this is what one would expect. The main thing is, can we detect differences between effective and ineffective anti-alcohol campaigns? And here you see the statistical map, what is significant between effective and ineffective. And what you see here is the precuneus, the dorsomedial prefrontal cortex, and the insula. These are critical regions which a host of studies has shown that they stand for self-relevant processing, for emotional stimulus processing, and for the processing of personally relevant information. And so again, we can show that using naturalistic stimuli, we can extract a meaningful signal which goes beyond perceptual, sensory perceptual brain regions, but touches into higher order processing regions, which are of interest to us, related to personal significance personal relevance and significance. So we found this very promising, but now we are still talking about group processes. And this is an fMRI study, and this is a picture of an fMRI. And there is a technique called hyperscanning. Then you have two scanners next to each other. But still, a scanner is not a good environment for studying group processes, because you either need to line up 5-6 scanners, which is horribly expensive and also technically demanding, or you try to move to a measure which is more feasible for group research. So we did the same as we did for the scanner, again with the EEG. The intersubject correlation is mathematically, the extraction is a little bit different, but otherwise it is very much the same way. You record EEG, you have a pipeline in which you extract maximally correlated EEG components, and typically you result with this kind of stimuli in 3 to 4 components. Interestingly, they are in their topography reproducible across labs, like what we find in our lab corresponds to what researchers from the Para lab, who actually developed this code, and this is the code we use, has a similar topography. They resemble each other. If we have these maximally correlated components, then we can, for each subject and each video, extract the intersubject correlation, and then we can submit this information to a statistical test. And so we have 4 components extracted to the same stimulus materials. All 4 components show a significant effect. Here, each and every participant has an increased ISC coefficient for the effective compared to the non-effective. It's also high for component C3 and C4. Component C2, 24 people show the effect in the right direction. 8 show it none effect or reversed, but still this is a highly significant effect. For us, this was surprising because it indicates to us that we are onto something which seems to be robust. But now the next thing is, what do these components stand for? And the classical EEG's Russ localization is a little bit tricky with this kind of data and this naturalistic stimuli. So we did a so-called EEG fMRI correspondence analysis. The trick here is that you can extract the time course for each EEG ISC component and use it as a regressor in a functional magnetic resonance analysis. And the trick is, the EEG is collected to one sample, the fMRI is collected to an entirely different sample. The only thing is that they viewed the same stimuli. And this is kind of interesting to see, if we find voxels in the fMRI to a different group, which co-vary with the EEG ISC measured in an entirely different study. Now this is a high threshold, this is whole head correction. So this is conservative, this is not something that we accept everything, this is rigorous testing. We see components 1 and 2, they are very much driven by stimulus features and by regions implicated in sensory perceptual processing. This is the main activity, this is also the largest entrainment we find in functional magnetic resonance imaging, this is expected. Components C3 and C4 are interesting, because there we have activity in the dorsomedial prefrontal cortex, there we have activity in the insula, and although it's difficult to see, there is a nice, not a real perfect overlap, but at least there is a suggestion of a convergence across methods. So this is a kind of a way we think, of course, having the same subjects would probably give you a much better alignment, but it's a good start. How you can detect the neural origin of these components. And for us, it's a good start, because we've shown that we can measure naturalistic stimulus processing using EEG. Now, that was the point when we thought it's the time now to buy EEG, mobile EEG. Now we have the mobile EEG, we unpack them, we hook them up, we are now able to measure EEG. Now, how do we go now from the I to the we, not me, the we, you all noticed, I know, how do we go from the I to the we? And in this endeavor, it is critical to distinguish between stimulus to brain coupling, what is driven by the stimulus. And this is what we know for sure we should see with our mobile EEGs in appropriate conditions. But we are more interested into this kind of brain-to-brain coupling in these higher order aspects, joint intentions, and collective engagement. So we need to come up now with good paradigms. And our reasoning at the moment is going all the way back, games. Games are great. Eigen and Winkler wrote a great book about games, about all kinds of aspects you can vary. You have full control. People like to play. They do it all the time. You can have cooperation. You can have competition. And you have a highly structured environment. So they give you all kinds of possibilities. Early on, I mentioned Skinner. Skinner already recognized the potential of games.
Pigeon pecks the ball back across the table. If it goes past one pigeon, the other pigeon can eat, and if it goes the other way, the other pigeon eats. So that there is a real, it's a real game. The pigeon.
So, I mean, he used it to demonstrate how effective operant conditioning is. That you can teach practically everything. Later on, this was not turning out that well. There was this misbehavior of organism article coming up. But this is a game, and this game, I have to say, is a little bit what was implemented as first computer game.
Der kanadische Hersteller Unis Technology hat auf der CES 2018 einen Pong-Tisch vorgestellt. Der offiziell Atari Table Pong getaufte Tisch ermöglicht es, Ataris Spielhallenklassiker in der realen Welt zu spielen. Gespielt wird mit Hilfe von Schaumstoffschlägern und einem Schaumstoffpixel, der als Puck funktioniert. Bewegt werden diese Spielelemente mit Hilfe von Magneten und Servomotoren, die unterhalb des Spielfeldes eingebaut sind. Die Latenz beim Spielen ist minimal und stört uns nicht. Die Steuerung durch die Servos führt zu einer recht markanten Art und Weise, wie sich die Elemente auf dem Feld bewegen, besonders beim Puck. Dennoch macht Pong auch 2018 noch Spaß, wie man am Stand von Unis an den Reaktionen der Spieler bemerkt hat. Ganz günstig ist der Pong-Tisch nicht. 2.800 US-Dollar soll das Gerät kosten. Der Europreis wird wohl 1:1 umgerechnet werden. Die passenden Hocker kosten jeweils 120 Dollar.
So, what I did not tell you so far is that measuring fMRI, measuring EEG is a little bit tricky. So far, this all sounds straightforward and the easy thing in the world to do. The EEG is a delicate signal, so. When your subject is biting your teeth, when your subject is making gross body movements, EEG signal is gone. When your subject is moving the eyes, the EEG signal is distorted. So this is why in the lab we usually take care that we have a very strict regime, instruct participants not to move around. And this is, of course, now a little bit what makes it difficult to study naturalistic situation. Now, here there are two players. And from an EEG or fMRI point of view, this is disaster because head movement fMRI is gone. EEG signal, if they move their hands, if they talk, this would be a great burden. But a game has a virtue that you can build teams. And this is what Tashfell showed in the 50s. You can easily build teams and they have an identity. They want to win together. Now with a team, if you identify with your team, you're in a unique position because there is this one player producing artifacts. But there are three people sitting around being on the team and do nothing but looking at what's happening. And this is now hopefully an avenue that we can study group processes with a very definite hypothesis. Now, what would be a success? A success would be if our brain can predict who is on which team. A success would be if our brain measure can show when is a group in harmony, when is it not performing well. Now these are hypotheses we are looking for, not just finding any kind of relation between different signals, but finding hypotheses which we can fail. And these are hypotheses, the likelihood that we succeed is not that high, it's not for sure. We can say no risk, no fun. Now the two groups I show you here, of course I'm presenting, but this is the work of a lot of people. Ralf Schmelzle is instrumental, he was a former postdoc, he's now at Michigan State University, and we are still collaborating with him on these issues. Martin, he conducted the anti-alcohol studies with fMRI and EEG. He will complete his PhD hopefully soon, and he will also participate in this kind of research. Britta, of course, you know all. The other team here is composed of other lab members which contribute now to this task. David Schubring, who is here, Tobias Fleisch, and Karl-Philipp Flösch, who is here. He starts his PhD program trying to conduct the studies. So what we are now in the process to is finding good games which we can bring in groups, measure EEG, and see if thereby we can go from the I to the me. But this, of course, requires effort, discussions among the different groups, with the group from Wolfgang Geismayer and Susanne Gold-Lücke, and the involvement of the informatic people, because it is for sure better if they try to analyze the signals, and finding, in particular when we come to dynamic changes in the signal, if there is a neural signature we can extract. And with Britta, of course, we not just want to measure EEG. Britta's group is trying to set up a system that we can use a video analysis and make a model of the person while they interact. And if we have that model, of course, with the EEG, it would be also nice to have body movements and head direction and these kind of measures which we add along. So there is quite a task ahead of us, but no risk, no fun. Thank you.
Inspired by your really nice idea about games, what about the mirror game? Do you know this? So Uri Alon came up with the mirror game.
Okay.
So it's a very interesting paradigm because it's just down to a single dimension.
Okay.
And so in the original paper, which I can send to you, it was in PNAS.
Yes.
The users just had to move. They could only move something left or right, right.
Yes.
And you're looking at the other person. The other person is also moving left and right. And as you'd expect, you know, like in bird flocks or whatever, you get these periods where one individual is the leader and the other
yes.
one is the follower. But what's most interesting about it is you get these periods of up to 9 seconds where there's zero time-like correlation between the two participants, which mm-hmm. seems to be miraculous. So they're moving with absolutely no time lag at all. And their hypothesis here is that you go through, so he's also very interested in improvisational theater and things like that, so how people connect. And so they built a dynamical systems model that, you know, if you build a model of what you think the other individuals going to do and they have a similar model, then perhaps, you know, you have these synchronized regimes, but you sort of defy, you seem to defy
yes.
the sort of laws of physics. And this should be a game that you could modify such that it would require tiny, tiny movements of, say, a joystick or something like that, and then you would just see it on a visual display. So you could play this game with one or multiple other individuals. And the interesting thing would be when you go into these zero time-like correlations, where there's complete synchrony between individuals, is this correlated then brain synchrony? What's special about these periods?
Yes.
It could be a nice way of sort of taking this idea, but having a more direct way of asking this question.
Yeah, no, I know that approach, and there is a ton of approaches and a ton of interesting things. And of course, we would like to test a game like that one. Also some kind of cooperation where you have to combine your activities to hit some goals. So we are thinking along these lines, and yes, that would be a great approach for this kind of research. Yes.
You also extend it to three players as well.
Yes.
He hasn't, I don't think, but I think it's a really interesting program.
Yes.
Helge? Yes, so I wonder about the team manipulations. Are you just assigning teams or how is your grouping process? So have you made plans for?
Well, as always, we start with the teams we have. So you will be at one point in the team. And our people will be at one point in the team. But of course, I mean, moving along, you can vary quite a bit if the people know each other and history, if you come from kind of series of loss and so forth. So there is a lot of potential. But as always, we start with the simple. And see, I mean, this is a step now if we can make this run and set up an analysis pipeline. But then there are lots of possibilities. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
The question about the synchronization you saw in the effect of the popular movies and the effective advertisements. How much do you think of an effect there would be related to people's personal preferences or, say, cultural differences, which would, for example, I think you showed a picture of a Western movie. So say you have people that didn't like Western movies and people that liked animated films, and you showed them both. Would you still see correlations at the same times, or would you see only correlations in the group with the preference, maybe like magnitude in the other?
Well, it depends on the kind of how similar are the cultures. I mean, you have to invoke a view of brain organization. There are regions which are very much related to the stimulus coming in. And so that information is the same. And so you would not necessarily huge differences in like the visual or auditory primary cortices. But the more you move towards when it comes to what meaning is attached to the stimulus, then it is just like having people with low and high worry. These regions, if it has different meaning, should then respond. And you would predict in higher order regions that there you see definitely differences. If it regards attentional regulation differences, you would also see it in these attention networks in the parietal cortices and so forth. But this is something which would be actually very interesting to study. Yeah?
So you showed us this very nice study about the electric shocks and the arrows pointing. So I was wondering, so you emphasized that these were couples, so they
yes.
can care for each other. Would it be very different if they were people who didn't know each other, or even when there's animosity between people? I could imagine it breaks well. Animosity works.
If you would not have your doctor already, I would say this is a very nice PhD program. We thought about this, but actually the next step we did was we changed the game a little bit because we just completed a study in which your reaction time determined the intensity of the shock for your partner. We thought this is kind of a little bit more different because it gives your, it's not passive, because usually in the world, what is empathy good for? I mean, you want to help. And so we wanted to make this a little bit more active and meaningful. And so we gave people control whether you get the bang or a bang. But what you said, we were talking about it, would also be good. But we would expect basically the same. And then doesn't make too exciting an experiment. Yeah?
It seems like with the synchrony study, the big thing that drives that is the video having a more consistent response. Is there any evidence you know of that actually comes up in social interactions or when there's a shared goal and so that it has some sort of social utility as well, just being this is a consistent emotional pattern?
Well, I think look about the Hollywood movie, I mean, they are designed to get you involved. And this is what makes them successful. So they are modeled according to real social situations and stylize them. And that presumably makes their success. And there is attempts to go frame by frame and see whether, for instance, if there are people, is it indeed that the fusiform gyrus is activated? Because we know classical fMRI research, the fusiform gyrus is responding to phases. And you can show this with naturalistic stimuli. But with this kind of emotional relevance, this is getting a little bit more tricky. And there are attempts, but it is not like investigated fully. So there is, it would be kind of interesting to fine grade this. And it would be also interesting, and we were thinking about it, because now it's effective versus ineffective anti-alcohol campaigns, what makes them effective? Because at the end, you would like to have it that the neural measures is a screening tool to say this is an effective mass media campaign because it can trigger activity in the audience in this and this and this brain regions which we want to target. We are far away from that, but this would be the ultimate goal of using these kind of measures in an applied context. So, no more questions. Thank you.